This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and joining me is Alina Evans, Area Director for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, where she's been positively influencing thousands of youth for the past decade. Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada has affordable after-school programming at 13 clubs, but while kids are out of school for the holidays, the clubs also have their winter break camp. Alina, thank you so much for being here today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada?
So Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, it's an after-school program for youth to come and participate in a variety of programs that we offer.
Okay, and what exactly is the winter break camp all about?
So the winter break camp, that is going to be, depending on your clubhouse, it's going to be either some type of STEM camp, some type of camp that is either based on movies. I know we have a Home Alone camp at one of our clubs. At a different clubhouse, they're going to be having a STEM camp. So it's going to vary throughout the different clubs across the valley.
So 13 different clubs, and you have 13 different holiday-related themes going on?
Exactly.
Okay, that's awesome. So when exactly does the camp run?
Yeah, so the camp is going to run next week from December 18th until December 22nd. So it'll be Monday through Friday next week. And then Fridays will end off with a fun, special activity for the youth to go ahead and begin their Christmas with. The camp typically is going to run from about 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the clubs. If it doesn't run from that time, it'll run from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. So it's going to be a three-hour time frame when these camps are going to be facilitated. So depending on the club, they will either have their camp during the morning time or they'll have it towards the afternoon.
So what's the age range for the kids that can attend the camps?
Yeah, so the age range is going to be from ages 6 to 18.
All right, and is there different programming for different age groups?
Absolutely. So the teens, which is our 13 to 18, they will participate in camps that are teen related to the clubhouse's theme, as well as the 6 through 12. The 6 through 12 will have scheduled planning for the youth program.
Okay, so basically, if the theme of that clubhouse happens to be STEAM, so science, technology, engineering, art, and math STEAM, so if that happens to be the theme of that clubhouse, there will be related activities for the kids and also related activities for the teens that are not exactly the same, but still related.
Absolutely, because the teens in our clubhouses, they have a separate space. So although they have different spaces, they will still continue to participate in STEM or STEAM-related activities.
Okay, awesome. So can you give us some examples of some of the activities that someone might take part in? I know it's going to change based on the theme, but you know, you've got one that's art, you've got some STEM ones, you've got a game show one, you've got a movie-related Hunger Games. That sounds interesting. So what are some of the different activities that the kids would be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorites, actually, the Ingolstead Clubhouse, which is located in the Central Region, they are having a Home Alone STEAM camp. So one of the classics, the movie Home Alone. So just in the movie, the kids are actually going to be creating multiple booby traps in their clubhouses that they will be building.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, I thought it was super cute.
So like including the paint can flying down and smashing someone in the face. I'm assuming they're not going to do the face part.
Well, no. We can do the face part, but yes, we will incorporate the paint into one of the STEM activities.
That's great. That sounds like so much fun.
Absolutely. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah. So what's the cost for the winter break camp?
Yeah, so right now, actually, before, you know, I talk the price, I want to let everybody know that we are running a promotional rate right now at the Boys and Girls Club. So if you have not attended the Boys and Girls Club all year, we are giving 1 week free for families in our community.
Awesome.
Now, if you have been attending the Boys and Girls Club, it's going to be a standard rate of $80 for the week. That is going to cover them being there from 7 a.m. till 6 p.m.
Okay, so even though the camp is only going for 3 hour chunks, the kids can stay at the Boys and Girls Club all day?
Absolutely. So Boys and Girls Club, we're open 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. You do not have to be there at 7. I know a lot of people call in like, do I have to be there at 7? No, you're free to drop off at any time that works best for you and your family. We want to make sure they get fed. They're ready to start the day off bright with a great attitude. We want to continue to give them that sense of belonging, get them creative with different ideas, do-it-yourself projects, and then ways for them just to be creative and learn new things. And after they continue to learn, we also have activities that are planned after the camps for them to participate in. And then we'll close at 6 p.m. So that is all ages 6 to 18.
Okay. And then if they don't want to go for the whole week, maybe only a couple days here and there, is there a drop-in available?
Yeah. So we do have a drop-in rate that is going to be $20 a day. So let's just say you need only Monday and Tuesday, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you guys are going to be out of town. It'll just be a fee of $20. Go ahead, bring your kid in, make sure they are enrolled, and we will take them and they will have fun.
Yeah. How exactly do they get enrolled and what's the deadline?
Yeah, so you can log in to www.bgcsnv.org. Again, that's www.bgcsnv.org. You will pick a clubhouse, so the clubhouse that is closest to you or maybe closest to your work. You will then create an online account, an online registration. It's a parent portal, and then you will go ahead and register for the winter break. So for the week of December 18th through the 22nd, and add it to your cart. Teens, they just have an annual rate. So they only pay an annual rate of $20. That's a one-time fee, and that covers them for a year.
So they pay for one day and they get a whole year, basically.
Exactly.
Although we're at the end of the year, so.
Yes, we are at the end of the year, but what's going to happen is they're going to be able to renew going into 2024. So once they do the annual membership fee, that membership for a teen that's ages 13 to 18 will cover from January of 2024 all the way until December 31st, 2024.
Awesome. Okay. And on the website that you mentioned, can they see the breakdown of the different themes that are associated with the different clubs?
They aren't going to be able to see the themes. I don't believe that they are posted on the website right now, but it's not an issue for you to call your local Boys and Girls Club and speak to someone located at the front desk, and they'll be able to tell you which clubhouse is themed with which days.
All right. That's perfect. There's some amazing looking themes and they all look so fun. So I don't know how people choose, but it looks like such a great time.
No, it's going to be a fun time. And you know, the clubs really put in their hard work to make this happen for our kids and to keep them busy for the winter break. And parents can trust to bring their kids here and know that this is a safe and positive environment.
That's awesome. Okay. So once again, the website is bgcsnv.org. This stands for Boys and Girls Clubs, Southern Nevada. So bgcsnv.org. You can see the locations of all 13 clubhouses around the valley. They run from edge to edge and through the middle. So wherever you are, there is a Boys and Girls Club close to you. And again, the winter break camp is running next week. So from December 18th through to the 22nd, the camp portion with the themed activities is either running 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. or 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. So it's a 3-hour chunk per day. But the kids and the teens can be at the club all the way from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. each of those days. And again, for kids from 6 to 12, it's $80 for the week for the winter break camp and the rest of the activities, or $20 per day if you want to do the drop-in rate. And for teens, it's just a $20 annual fee and the rest is all included. So no need to worry about that. So once again, the website with all the information, bgcsnv.org. And Alina, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know what you guys are doing during the holidays. Sounds like a great set of activities to keep the kids busy and having fun, you know, because it's the holiday season. It's not like they're going to school. They're having fun. This sounds like awesome. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Heather, you know, just for having me and letting me share our excitement, what's going on next week for winter break. We're hoping to see a lot of the kids in our community.
Every child deserves good vision to be able to read, learn, or kick a ball. Each day a child can't see, they fall behind. Together we can change that. Eye Care for Kids is the solution. In the past 21 years, we've helped over 500,000 underserved children with vision screenings, exams, and eyeglasses. Your contribution today can provide the gift of sight for a child tomorrow in Las Vegas. Donate now at eyecare4kids.org.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Kate Porter, co-executive director of the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. The museum has a new international wildlife gallery called Biomes Beyond Borders, and through the holiday season, they're also featuring the December to Remember exhibit. Kate, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
So when was the Las Vegas Natural History Museum first established?
So we're really different compared to most of the other natural history museums you may see in the world, because we were started by a really small group of volunteers back in 1989. We opened to the public in 1991, and everything that you see in the museum today has either been donated or fundraised for by our community, because we're still an independent nonprofit 32 years later.
Wow, nice. Okay. So primarily, what do the exhibits focus on?
Oh, a little bit of everything, which is the fun part. So we really look at our mission as inspiring folks to learn more. So the exhibits, of course, focus on natural history, but that can be such a broad category. So we really take advantage of that. So everything from the marine life gallery to ancient Egypt. We take a look at prehistoric life, both mammals and dinosaurs. We've got a working paleontology lab. And then our newest gallery that we just reopened to the public is our International Wildlife Gallery.
Yeah, so tell us about this new wildlife gallery. It's called Biomes Beyond Borders. And what's it all about?
A lot of people don't realize that a habitat or an ecosystem fits into a broader category that really does go beyond borders. So we wanted to show folks that different types of climate, be it the precipitation, so maybe the rain or snow, and the temperature, really affect how different plants and animals adapt to where they live. And you can see these sort of like bands across the entire globe with these different biomes. And so you've got like a grassland biome or a forest biome. And the neat thing about it is whatever is unique to that particular region affects how the animals and the plants specifically adapt there. But you can see a lot of different patterns across that biome throughout the whole world. So it's really an exhibit about interconnectedness at the end of the day.
Okay. What sort of scientific review was involved when you were creating the Biomes Beyond Borders Wildlife Gallery?
We were really fortunate. We had a small panel of scientists from UNLV, as well as the museum, who assisted us with the interpretive process and with the review process. And it was really quite a challenge. They were so knowledgeable. So it was really quite a challenge to get their vast body of knowledge down into something that was really digestible for the public. But already, even though the exhibition hall's only been open for really just a couple months at this point, we're excited because we're already working behind the scenes on some supplementary material. So for folks who want to learn more, there's more coming in 2024.
Nice. Okay. Now, obviously, you're kind of the expert on these types of exhibits, but I'm curious, what's the most interesting thing that you've learned about our planet through the Biomes Beyond Borders exhibit?
Ooh, that's a great question, Heather. I think for me, it was really eye-opening to learn about the American grasslands. I think we take the Great Plains for granted here, and there are definitely much more lush and diverse from, you know, just kind of our perspective, my perspective, areas represented within the gallery. But I found out just how vulnerable and endangered the American Great Plains are, the grasslands here are, and, you know, what that means for the ecological diversity there. And so who knew, right here in our own backyard, basically, that we had one of the most rapidly declining biomes on the planet, really.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Now tell us about the holiday exhibit, which is called A December to Remember.
Yes, this is my favorite time of year at the museum. Who doesn't love a little festive cheer?
Yeah.
I know, right? So first and foremost, it's an exhibit created by the community right here in Southern Nevada. It's curated by the museum team, but this is either organizations or even individuals that want to share their personal traditions through their own lens with our community. So it's really beautiful. We've got representation of, you know, Hanukkah, of course. There's a Jewish girls' school in Henderson that put together a lovely exhibit. And we've got the Virgin of Guadalupe from a local family. Inner Circle Sanctuary is one of the local Wiccan groups, and they talk about Yule and the Wheel of the Year, just a little bit of everything. And we're always welcoming new folks to join the exhibition as well. And in fact, the Hawaiian Pacific Islander Association did a much larger exhibit this year. They were able to secure some space in our larger case. And so they've got this really big, beautiful exhibit right as you come through the door, celebrating different Hawaiian traditions as well.
Nice. Okay. So now normally when we're thinking of museums, we're thinking of static exhibits that you look at. But what are some of the workshops and interactive activities that are part of A December to Remember?
Oh, you've done your homework. I love that. Gosh, this is really the best part of the whole exhibition, because not only are these community members creating exhibits, like you said, static exhibits that folks can come and view on a daily basis, but throughout the entire exhibition, which goes until January 7th, we've got different workshops every weekend, slash starting next week, it'll be daily as well, where folks are sharing these personal traditions. And so we kicked it off with the art of flower arranging, Japanese flower arranging, and the Kizuna Society doing calligraphy and origami. On the 17th, we've got Jewish Nevada coming to share their Hanukkah traditions. On Kwanzaa, we actually have a gentleman named Ellis Rice, who has a beautiful presentation about the cultural significance and the true meaning of Kwanzaa. And so he's going to be sharing that as well. And so really, whatever folks' tradition is, if they're interested in leading a workshop, we're here to host it. And we're really excited that the community can come in, do hands-on crafts, ask the presenters about their traditions, and really kind of dive into what that holiday tradition means.
Nice. That sounds fun.
It is.
Yeah. Okay. So where exactly is the museum located?
This is the biggest question I get asked. And everybody who knows us says we are the best kept secret in Las Vegas. And I keep telling folks, we're not a secret. We're on North Las Vegas Boulevard at the corner of North Las Vegas and Washington. So we're right next door to the historic Mormon Fort State Park and right up the street from the Neon Museum.
Yeah, and it's basically right there at the spaghetti bowl. You know, get off either, get off the I-15, get off the 95, and it's right there.
Exactly. Right over here by Cashman. Yep.
Yeah, nice. Okay. So where can people go if they want to find out more about the Las Vegas Natural History Museum in general, or about the current A December to Remember exhibit that's happening through January 7th, or the new Biomes Beyond Borders, which is the International Wildlife Gallery?
We always encourage folks to go to our website, which is just the first letters of our name. So LV, like Las Vegas, NHM, naturalhistorymuseum.org. So lvnhm.org, they can find a full calendar of upcoming events. They can check out details about planning their visit here. We do have free parking on site. We are wheelchair accessible, things like that. So they can check that out. But if they're looking for a little bit more kind of information or maybe a little behind the scenes, I always recommend too to follow us on social media. We're on all platforms as Las Vegas Natural History Museum. And then our handle is LVNHM, and the M kicks off museum. So you can find us that way too.
Okay, perfect. So once again, the website is lvnhm.org, stands for Las Vegas Natural History Museum, lvnhm.org. There's always exhibits and plenty of things to see at the Las Vegas Natural History Museum all year round. The new Biomes Beyond Borders exhibit is their International Wildlife Gallery, and that tells a lot of interesting things about biomes around the world, different ecosystems. And then right now, during the holiday season, a December to Remember is running. It runs all the way through to January 7th, and it's not only exhibits put on by the community, various holiday traditions are showcased, but they also have interactive activities and workshops. And you can find all of that at the website lvnhm.org or on social media, Las Vegas Natural History Museum, and the handle is at LVNH Museum, at LVNH Museum. And again, you can find all of that at lvnhm.org. And we've been speaking with Kate Porter. She's the co-executive director of the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. And Kate, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know all the amazing things you've got going on. It just seems like one thing after another. It's always something to do. And like you said, people do think it's the best kept secret because it's right there, but people don't know it's right there. So once again, it's on the corner of North Las Vegas Boulevard and Washington, near Cashman Field, near the Neon Museum, and you can find it all at lvnhm.org. Thank you so much, Kate. I appreciate your time.
Oh my gosh, Heather, thank you so much. And I can't wait to see you and all the listeners at the museum soon.
Everyone has a community, a neighborhood, school, kids' teams, where you worship, work, work out, or any other place or group where you choose to belong. Communities can provide support when you need it, and even when you don't know you do. Like when it comes to preventing underage drinking and other substance use, community members can be your eyes and ears when you're not with your kids and alert you to signs of potential problems. Learn more at talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Lorraine Martin, President and CEO of the National Safety Council. The council recently launched the Respond Ready Workplace Initiative that focuses on saving lives and making workplaces safer. Lorraine, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Heather.
So what exactly is the National Safety Council?
The National Safety Council has been in existence for about 110 years. And we are the nation's leading advocate for ensuring that people don't lose their life or get injured when we can prevent that from happening. So we look at the data and ask what is causing people to get injured or lose their life and what can we do about it to prevent that.
Okay. Now, what is this new NSC program, Respond Ready Workplace?
Yeah. So right now, Heather, overdoses in our country, and there are about 200 a day, are the leading cause of what we would call an unintended death. And these deaths can happen anywhere, anytime. They can happen on the job. And our Respond Ready Workplace is helping workers and employers understand that right now about 9% of all deaths in workplaces are from overdoses. So we need to be ready, just like we are with other kinds of first aid response, to ensure that that person gets a second chance at life. And Respond Ready Workplaces are ones that would have what we call a opioid overdose reversal medication, in this case, it's called naloxone, available so that when that emergency does happen, it can be used to save a life.
Okay. So how would this naloxone be administered in the workplace?
Yeah, so naloxone is now available over the counter, and that's one of the reasons why this initiative is so timely right now. In March, the FDA approved several different providers of this medicine. And the kind that is available right now that we would recommend for first aid kits is a nasal spray. And so it is really simple to administer. You just basically spray it into someone's nose if they're having an overdose. And it's extremely effective in enabling that person now to literally go from perhaps not breathing to being alive and available for when emergency responders can be getting to them. So it gives you that time. Very easy to administer. We've trained. I just was recently in Congress and was training some of the staff there. It's very easy to learn it, and it can't hurt somebody. Whether they're overdosing or you've misdiagnosed it, it can't hurt them. So it's just a really important first aid tool to have on hand, not only in workplaces, but other places as well.
Okay. Now, if someone happens to not have gotten the naloxone yet and someone in the workplace has an overdose, what can we do about that?
Yeah, call 911 fast.
Okay.
Because it can happen pretty quickly, especially with some of the drugs that are now laced with fentanyl, which is extremely potent and deadly. Call, get emergency response as quickly as you possibly can. And, you know, if this does happen to you, let's make sure your first aid kits are well equipped next time and you do have naloxone on hand and you've trained your staff.
So when we do have naloxone, you administer it through the nose and still call 911, right?
Absolutely. Every time.
Okay. Now, what can employers do if they want to develop new policies that take recovery-ready initiatives into effect?
You know, employers can play a really important role in all kinds of safety things because what you learn at work, you take home. But where workplaces can be sort of recovery supportive, recovery friendly, it's really important not only to know if somebody's struggling and get them support, whether it's EAP programs, healthcare, mental health programs. This is happening to a lot of our colleagues, our friends, our family members, and workplaces can be a place of intervention to get support. And then also be the place that enables that person to get their job back if they have lost their job or if they had to go into recovery. A statistic that will be very probably surprising to many is that workers who are in recovery actually miss fewer days overall of absenteeism than just a regular employee, about 3.6 per year. They are loyal. They need that job. The job is so important to their lives. And recovering employees are very valued employees. And I get a chance to meet and talk to many of them. And having that job on the other side of their journey is imperative.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that 9% of deaths in the workplace are from overdoses. So obviously, there are deaths from other reasons as well. So what other tips do you have to make workplaces safer in general?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And that is what we exist for, is to provide those kinds of services. So you can always go to nsd.org workplace to get all kinds of resources. But things like safe driving. Driving is still one of the highest underneath overdoses, risky things that people do for their job, whether it's a forklift or a delivery truck. So get good driving training and techniques, lots of policies and support around things having to do with slips, trips, and falls, other kinds of protections for using ladders and making sure that you do that effectively. We've got every resource you could imagine to support workplaces being safe. And it's really important that you really do look at a very holistic approach to keeping your employees safe so they go home at night to their families in the same condition you got them. And just being prepared for an overdose is just one of those tools.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay, so you mentioned the website nsc.org/workplace, and that's where listeners can find more information and more resources that you mentioned.
They sure can. They can also go to nsc.org/respondready. And that will get them to very specifically some of the tools and advice around ensuring that you are ready and equipped for an emergency overdose.
Perfect. Okay. So nsc.org/workplace is the website to go to if you want to find more tips around workplace safety. And then if you're looking for information on the Respond Ready Workplace initiative that launched around naloxone and preventing overdoses in the workplace, the website for that is nsc.org/respondready. So nsc.org/workplace, nsc.org/respondready. And Lorraine Martin, President and CEO of the National Safety Council, I want to thank you so much for being here and talking with us, sharing these tips and these initiatives that are so important. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Charlie did not die from an overdose. Charlie was poisoned.
No other family should go through this. It's just horrific.
Go to safe.pharmacy. Use the free tool. Learn if the online pharmacy you're using is safe.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Megan Reardon Jarvis, a clinical psychotherapist and consultant who specializes in helping people overcome trauma. She's also a two-time TEDx speaker, host of the podcast Grief is My Side Hustle, and author of the new book, End of the Hour, A Therapist's Memoir. Megan, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
So what prompted you to write your book, End of the Hour?
My book is about my experience with the deaths of both of my parents. My dad died of small cell cancer over the course of a year. Small cell cancer is pretty much a death diagnosis when you get it. And then 2 years later, my mother died suddenly while I was on vacation with her at her house with my kids and my dog. And I wrote the book because the two experiences were so different and yet so similar to the people that I have worked with as a therapist for the past 20 years. So my experience with my dad's death was what I would say, you know, the word is manageable. I was sad. It was very hard. Death is always hard. It always changes things. You feel different. But it didn't really like knock me off my life track. It didn't rearrange all my emotional furniture. It rearranged maybe like a couch and a chair. Mm-hmm. When my mother died, I was completely and totally sort of taken out at the knees. And I really wanted to write a book both that acknowledged the stories that I've heard from clients for 20 years, but also that put a clinical lens, sort of what I understood as a clinician, about why those two experiences were so wholly different.
Okay. So how does reading about your story and your journey through grief help others who are going through their own grief or trauma?
Oh, it's such a good question. You know, I'm a huge reader and always have been, but I'm a relatively new writer. And I think the purpose of writing is exactly in the heart of the question that you just asked, which is you can write to sort of get your own experience out on paper, to sort of come to know yourself better. But I think when we go into the reading of something, we are looking for ourselves in that book, in whatever it is that's been published. I think we're looking to be validated with our own experience. After my mom died, this is going to sound crazy because a little bit it is, I read 188 books about grief and loss.
Wow.
And really what I was looking for, a lot of people can't read in profound loss. I couldn't read when my dad died. I just couldn't stop reading when my mom died. And really what I was looking for was sort of that sensation of finding a friend in the dark. So people could be writing about losing a child. They could be writing about a divorce. They could be writing about their own experience with a health problem. But all of those things include a element of real and profound loss. And that I always found the emotions related to loss, which really is what grief is, I always found it so comforting to understand that other people had survived that experience.
Yeah. I'm surprised that you say you're pretty new to writing, because to me, it's written like a novel more than just a nonfiction self-help book. So I would have thought that you'd been writing for decades.
Well, that is a really kind thing to say. You know, again, I read a couple of books a week, and I think I understand writing, although I will tell you that I did not remember any of the grammar of writing. And so thank God for editors, because I didn't know how to use quotation marks. But a lot of the writing for me felt the way writers sometimes talk about it, like it felt almost spirit driven or something. Like I would wake up in the middle of the night. One of my real grief symptoms was that I was having trouble sleeping. And so I would wake up at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, kind of with words forming and sentences forming in my head and not really knowing where they were taking me. And my early writing was more like almost like epic poetry or a blog post. And when I looked at those stories and thought, hey, let's try to put them into an arc that makes sense, there was a whole lot of editing that had to happen, which is, you know, another process completely. And I was lucky to have people help me and really be willing to teach me how to do that well.
That's awesome. Okay, now when we're talking about grief, we often hear about the stages of grief, but what are your thoughts on that model of understanding?
Yeah, I think everybody who works as a grief expert sort of has a love-hate relationship with the five stages, because they are not real. It's a little bit like saying that the earth is flat, but worse than that, they were never actually intended for grievers. They were intended for people who were going through the dying process. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote them first, she wrote them as a map for people who had terminal illness, so that they could understand from her experience, which was vast with people who were dying, what to kind of expect And you can imagine how that would be helpful to somebody who was going through the process of losing their life. But because we didn't have a similar kind of person in the grief world who was working with the people who were left behind after loss, we didn't have anything to hold on to. And so we latched on to Elizabeth's five stages. And then there were a whole bunch of other academics and people who do run studies who added sort of other sort of stage theory to it. But the reality is, and we do have so much documentation about this, that grief is a process, but it is not a linear process. And it does have some qualities to them that are similar across kind of the human experience, but that one of the stages of in Elizabeth's five stages is bargaining. You know, if someone dies suddenly, you're probably not going to do any bargaining because there's nothing to bargain about them. You learned that they died, not that they were dying slowly of a terminal illness. So one of the things that's sort of hard and frustrating is that we have not done what we do with other hard topics. Like I think about, I have an 11-year-old. He's just going through that horrible, embarrassing process of taking the classes at school that are about how your body changes through puberty. So we could have classes like that about what is typical in grief and loss. And in fact, I'm writing a book right now that sort of is that curriculum, but we just don't. And I think if the field was able to add more core education about what is typical, and what is typical is your reaction. What is more typical is how it might land with you in your system. Like when I said I didn't sleep very well, that's really typical. To have digestive problems is really typical. To have some physical pain is really typical. So if we were able to educate sort of the general population better, I think the general population might be more willing to let go of the only roadmap they've really been given, even though it's not an accurate map.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when you mention those physical symptoms, it's interesting sometimes how we think it's an emotional problem, but it's actually, you know, emotions affect the physical body and the physical body affects the emotion. So, you know, it's a cyclical thing. So what are some of the common physical warning signs that we're going through mental distress as a result of trauma?
Yeah, God, great question. So I'll give like a tiny little bit of biophysical description for this, which is that the brain has 12 cranial nerves that send information. So think about it like a mailman goes these 12 routes down into the body from the brain. And then the body and the brain together have 12 systems. So those systems are like your digestive tract and your reproductive tract and your respiratory tract, all that. So that those are the ways in which the brain functions and the body functions. And what happens when you go through a trauma is there's a tiny little part. It's actually like the size of a walnut or an almond in the back of your brain called the amygdala. And it enlarges when you are in a threat state. So that could be if, you know, if there's a bear in your living room, it would enlarge, but certainly anything death related, because we are wired to try to survive, will make the amygdala enlarge. And when the amygdala enlarges, it stops the typical currency, it stops the mail from being delivered correctly. So when I'm working with clients, I ask them about their 12 physical systems. You know, one of the physical systems is the augmentary system, which no one's ever heard of, which is your skin, nails, and hair. And so I say, have you had any rashes or hives, or is your hair falling out? And for many people who are grieving, that is happening, but they don't want to admit it's happening, or they didn't connect it to a grief experience. So the symptoms that we see that are the most common are digestive issues. So people can have long-standing like diarrhea or long-standing nausea or not be able to eat or feel like they need to eat a lot more than normal than had been typical for them. Sleep can be really disrupted. And that's, you know, sleep is driven by a hormone process. And so when you think about the mail being misdelivered, it's not just the one house that it's impacted. It's all the kind of, you know, energetic houses on the street. So your hormones are not being produced properly because the energy is not going to those places. People often have migraines and headaches, and their blood pressure may shift, and that's your vascular system, and sort of phantom pain. So your muscular skeletal system, it's very common to have lower back pain or to have your back go out. But I've had people who have vision issues, who have pain in their throat, just all kinds of symptoms that when they come in to see me, which is usually a year after they have experienced a profound loss, you know, they think their body is falling apart and that they're going a little crazy. The thing that is really helpful when they come in for trauma treatment, and trauma treatment isn't like we see it on The Sopranos where you go to a therapist and you just sort of talk to them. Mm-hmm. Trauma treatment is more like when you go to a physical therapist and they do stretches on your body. That treatment can help regulate, get back into the normal zone, the amygdala, and then all the other elements that have been dysregulated. It takes time. It's not a one-shot deal, but it's really important for people to know when they're suffering with those symptoms that there's things that people can do to help.
Wow, awesome. Okay. So when you're talking about the amygdala, basically trauma puts us into fight or flight, and that's what triggers the physical symptoms?
Yeah, that's a great way of thinking about it. And again, I'll just give you like a little neuroscience. So the brain has two sides to it. And I don't mean like, oh, are you creative or are you more mathematic? It has two sides to it in terms of how it activates systems. So fight and flight are from the right side of the brain, and they are the activated side of the brain. So when you are able to fight against something or run away from something, your outcomes in terms of your central nervous system, which is your brain and your spinal cord, is staying sort of okay. That is better when you're able to fight or flee. There's a freeze state, which is like a deer in headlights, or a collapse state, which is like rolling into a ball and just trying to survive. When you roll into a ball and just try to survive, that actually switches the energy from the right side of the brain where you're trying to be active to the left side of the brain where you're just trying to stay still and not die. And that is where trauma happens. When we end up in a helpless state, that we are much more susceptible to having the trauma make meaning inside our system. And the thing with death is, unless it's your own, you know, you're chased down an alley by a thug, if you have learned that your mother died suddenly, there is no thing to fight and there's nothing to flee. Mm-hmm. So we are much more susceptible to being traumatized by that terrible event because the thing that helps us defend against hard things isn't even applicable in this moment.
Wow. I love that explanation. It's like mind blown. Now I understand.
Right?
Wow.
Right? Isn't it? And let me say one other thing, because I think it's really helpful for listeners. Trauma is just a terrible thing that happens, and it can be anything. COVID was a collective trauma for the entire world. But when we're talking about being traumatized, what we mean is that bad thing landed in your system and made you feel helpless. That's what traumatized is. We use that word traumatized a lot, like, oh, my football team lost and I'm traumatized. You could be, but really what we mean with traumatized is my system is now carrying around inside it a form of helplessness that then makes it more reactive and causes distress more quickly and probably has a whole series of physical symptoms that may need treatment. And part of the reason I wrote the book is I really wanted people to be able to see the difference between grief that is quote unquote typical and will resolve on its own over time, and grief that is an illness that needs a lot of intervention thrown at it. And, you know, the real sort of nugget about it is if anybody should have been able to circumnavigate grief without it knocking her out at the knees, it's me. I have 2 master's degrees, 20 years of experience, and countless other professional trainings, but it didn't stop me from absorbing that profound kind of grief that became, for me, an illness.
Wow. Okay, now let's go back to, you mentioned your 11-year-old son. So
yes.
dealing with grief is tough enough for adults, obviously. I mean, we've been talking about this, but how should we speak with children about death and sadness?
It's so important. So the beginning part of my book, what I talk about, it sort of sets me up for the trauma later, is that I was 9 years old when someone who was considered an extended member of my family drowned unexpectedly. And he was a teenager. And because it was the early 80s, the way that we managed that was to sort of never talk about it again. Mm. And what happens to children, you know, children believe in fairies and they believe in Santa and they believe in magic because their minds don't really have a more comprehensive way to understand how everything happens in the world. Children are also profoundly narcissistic, meaning they believe they cause most of the things that happen and that they are the most important person in all of the vignettes of their life. As you get older, obviously your brain develops so that you can take in more perspective. But for children, they need, it's almost like you're kayaking next to them and the water gets a little bit wavy. They will be more stable if they are roped to your boat than if you leave them to kind of navigate it by themselves. They will feel more stable and they will know that they are not expected to do it all themselves. When you don't help kids with hard things, and the hard thing could be that they were being bullied at school and you're like, well, you have to work that out yourself. When you don't help them, what happens with that mass amount of feeling, whether it's fear or sadness, is it transmutes from this is an experience I'm having, an emotional experience I'm having, very quickly into this is who I am. So a kid will go from I feel sad to I am sad to I am a sad kid.
Mm.
And many of the clients, you know, most of the people that I've worked with over the past 20 years have trauma. So when they come in, they may not know that. They may just know, and this was certainly my experience, I just kind of knew that I reacted to the world differently than a lot of other people that I saw. I felt like I was more sensitive than they were. I felt like I couldn't recover the way that other people could. And really, up until I was in my early 20s, when I went to my first therapist, I really thought about that with criticism about myself. Other people are better at this than me. And when I went to my first therapist, what she said to me was, listen, you had this terrible experience and all of this emotion about it when you were a child and nowhere for that emotion to go to make sense. And so you just carried it. And you were more reactive, you were more upset, you were more sensitive, but not because you were born that way or you were bad, but because no one taught you how to offload that energy. And that's the thing that I think as a therapist is so important for people to know, is that we have all these tools and techniques to help you not have to sort of be in the spin cycle of your emotion, that you can move through it. But it's not something that everybody figures out how to do innately. And so we just teach you, you know, I don't know, I probably know 100 tools to teach people to move through those emotions. Most of those tools work really, really well with kids.
Okay. Now, we've been talking about the trauma that we deal with, but how can we honor the loved ones that we've lost without getting stuck in grief again?
Oh, God, I love your questions, Heather. That's such a good question. So this is the image that I use with people. You're walking down a path in your life that is filled with people you love, things that you enjoy, parts that are hard, things that have been difficult. But this is a path that you are actively choosing by walking down it. When there's a profound loss, it's like a giant meteor comes and it hits the path and you can't go over it or under it right away because you're stunned and terrified. As you begin to acclimate, like, wow, this is a thing that really happened. This meteor came out of the sky. This person died. This event is real. As you begin to acclimate, you're kind of just standing still. What we need in grief and what we look at as grief work is figuring out a way forward. And it's going to be hard. You used to be walking on a path that you could see forward. When something awful happens, you can't see your way forward, but you still have to try to move forward. And so, like for the holidays, let's say, you know, I know I'm working with a number of people who they have had a loved one who has died in the past year. This is going to be their first Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or whatever without their person. And so what they're saying to me is, how do I do this? What they mean is, how do I do it and not feel bad? Mm-hmm. And so what I say to them as a therapist is, it's okay to feel bad. It's reasonable to feel bad. It makes sense that you feel bad. If you try not to feel bad, you're going to make yourself feel worse. So whether it's us or whether it's someone that we love and we know that they're going through a loss and they're going to be sitting at a table that's missing someone over the holidays, what I say is, do not try to pretend that that is not happening. So find a way to acknowledge that it's happening. And this is a process that can take weeks with clients, but I will say, would you like to honor them with a, you know, a dish, make a food that they like? Is there music that you could listen to? What about jewelry that you could wear or a story you could tell? But something that brings the pain in the door and allows people to hear it and have it be acknowledged and recognized. Because what most people think they are supposed to do, particularly on the holidays, which are billed as like, you know, the most wonderful time of the year, they think they're supposed to snap up the pain and not experience it. But that just... A, it doesn't work. We're not actually really able to do that. It drives other behaviors like drinking or fighting or, you know, or isolating. So instead of doing that, you know, being able to say, hey, I'm going to bring pumpkin pie to Christmas dinner because that was my husband who died's favorite pie. And, you know, just bring it into the room so that people can feel it. I will tell you that my practice as a griever and a grief expert is that when I feel that tightness in my throat, which is how I know I'm having grief, when I feel that tightness in my throat, I immediately text my sister and my best friend. And I say something, I just heard a song. My mom loved that song by John Lennon, the Christmas song. That's now everywhere. And so I hear it and I'm like, oh, mom's song is on. It's killing me. Most of the time, I'm not even asking for an intervention. I just don't want to be in the moment by myself. I don't want to be the only person who knows that I'm having a grief reaction. So it can be big. You can start a tradition or bring in a tradition, or it can be small, just a little moment in between you and another person where you say, I'm having a hard time.
Okay, awesome. All right, so this has been very fascinating. So if people want to continue and learn more about you, get the book called End of the Hour, or listen to your podcast, Grief is My Side Hustle, where could they go for those things?
Yeah, so End of the Hour, the book is everywhere. So you can order it on Amazon, you can get it in your local bookstore, you can probably get it in your library. And you can find me if you want to talk to me or get in touch. Just Google my name. My website is Megan Reardon Jarvis. But because Reardon is hard for people to remember how to spell, you can also just Google Grief is My Side Hustle. It'll all take you to the same place. I'm really active on Instagram. That's where I let people know, you know, when I have book events coming up or if I have a speaking engagement. So that's a good place to follow me, but feel free to DM me. My team and I, we read all the notes and we try to respond to every single one of them.
Nice. Okay. So if you want to read the book, End of the Hour, A Therapist Memoir, you can find that at any of your favorite booksellers, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, at the library. If you want to listen to Megan's podcast, it's called Grief is My Side Hustle. If you Google Grief is My Side Hustle, it's the fastest way to get to her website, but you can also type it in, and I will spell it. It's MeganReardonJarvis.com. That's MeganReardonJarvis. JARVIS, MeganReardonJarvis.com, or find her on Instagram and connect there. And Megan, I want to thank you so much for being here. This has been very enlightening and informative, and I appreciate you sharing your journey and giving some tips and some strategies for people who are also going through trauma or grief. So I really appreciate your time here today. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved your questions. This was a really lovely interview. I'm grateful to have spent this time with you.
The changing of seasons can affect how you feel. 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Three Square's 14th annual Holiday Match campaign is happening through December 31st. This campaign's designed to double your impact in our community throughout the holiday season, as all donations are matched thanks to the generosity of Nevada Gold Mines, operated by Barrick, Boyd Gaming Corporation, and Intermountain Healthcare. So now every dollar donated can provide up to 6 meals for hungry residents in Southern Nevada. Donate, volunteer, or find out more at 3square.org. That's 3square.org. Miracle Flights is lighting up downtown Summerlin for the holiday season with their third annual Lights for Flights display of 7 positive words through January 1st. Lights for Flights is an interactive holiday experience and photo op that also lets shoppers give back to the nonprofit Miracle Flights. Get more info or make a donation at miracleflights.org. That's miracleflights.org. And the Las Vegas Natural History Museum's running its holiday exhibit, A December to Remember, through January 7th. It includes community displays, interactive activities, and workshops that showcase various holiday traditions. And they also have a new permanent international wildlife gallery called Biomes Beyond Borders. The museum's located on North Las Vegas Boulevard at Washington, near Cashman Field and the Neon Museum, and you can find out all the details on their various exhibits and events at lvnhm.org. That stands for Las Vegas Natural History Museum, lvnhm.org. Or follow them on Facebook and LinkedIn at Las Vegas Natural History Museum and LVNH Museum on Twitter and Instagram.